from secondary energy to primary energy. Dr. Compton is going to take us through the petroleum pipeline industrial regulation.
Good morning, Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Members. Thank you very much for the opportunity to talk about the petroleum sector. Very briefly, the genesis of regulation that you asked for, as far as we can establish it, started in the 1940s when there was cutthroat competition, led to sectoral decline, and then there was government intervention in an early form of the retail rationalisation plan. In the 50s and 60s, the first oil refineries were built with government intervention through incentives of various kinds. The first refinery was built in 1954 and it's still running, and so are all of the others that were built in the 50s and 60s. So most of them are now fairly old. In the 70s, there was the United Nations oil embargo, and that led to the Petroleum Products Act and the CEF Acts of 1977. Secrecy was introduced, and towards the end of the 70s, 80s, synthetic fuels were introduced through regulation and massive incentives from government. In the 1998, we had the White Paper on Energy Policy, which changed the whole direction of government involvement in the sector. Secrecy was removed, a demand-side approach was taken, and that implementing that policy led to the Petroleum Pipelines Act of 2003, which is more the subject of today's discussion, and then later the National Energy Regulator Act 2004. Briefly, to give you a sense of where we stand, this is oil consumption. This is specifically crude oil, so you'll see we are somewhere between Algeria and Egypt. It's a little bit misleading because this is not taking into account the synthetic fuels production, which if you added that would raise the green line, which is the South African consumption of crude oil, but it does give you the trend, which is that it's fairly flat. Some statistics for you on what we are currently regulating. Most of the pipelines belong to Transnet pipelines, but there are also private sector pipelines. The very large crude oil storage capacity is a hangover, if you like, from apartheid, where you have very large strategic stocks, tanks, and that's why it's sort of unusually large for an economy this size. And then we have the port loading facilities and various other storage facilities. I won't dwell on this. In terms of licenses, that's the numbers we've issued, and for each of those 199 licenses, there's a document like this that gives the reasons for the decision and the license conditions, and on our website you'll find all 199 of those, plus 57 that of revoked licenses and the amendments of licenses. The area I want to touch on now, by way of introduction, is the number of construction licenses on hold for various reasons. The number is small, not very exciting, but the billions of rand behind that number is what is of concern. And it's not one simple single explanation. Some of it is for reasons of problems among shareholders, of investors and things like that, but others are regulatory problems, and I'm going to touch on that a bit more later on. If we want to know what do we regulate in terms of the Petroleum Pipelines Act, three things. Ooh, Esther, Stardom. That's called getting ahead of yourself. So, okay, there's the upstream in the oil sector. This is oil sector. Now, you go back some more. You're too far there. Start there. So we regulate marine loading facilities. This is on the seashore, both offshore buoys and wharfside marine loading facilities. We regulate storage facilities of various kinds, and we regulate pipelines of various kinds. So those are the main three things that we regulate. In terms of who regulates what in this sector, it's a bit of a mixed picture. On the upstream and the downstream, we've got different regulators that sort of mix and match, as it were. On the upstream, we've got the Petroleum Agency of South Africa and the Department of Mineral Resources, who are regulating the upstream. That's oil and gas exploration and mining. On the downstream, for refining and wholesaling, the Minister of Energy is the regulator in terms of the Petroleum Products Act. In the midstream, where we play, there's the loading facilities, pipelines and the storage. Now these pictures or these schematics are not by accident shown overlapping other sectors here. That's on purpose to indicate that there's overlapping jurisdiction here between different regulators. And that's the point we want to make. And then on the retailing end, it's back to the Minister of Energy. So very simply, you've got three or four regulators in one value chain. And some of them have got overlapping jurisdiction. And we'll talk about that a bit more later because it does lead to complications and difficulties for investors. I just want to make a simple point here that since this Act came into being, there's been an unprecedented boom in investment. I haven't gone into detail here. I can at a later stage if you request. But I'm not saying it's causal. I'm not saying the advent of the Act caused it. It probably is a happy coincidence, but there has been a boom. So we shouldn't forget this significant feature. Possibly could have been bigger. Right, the challenges. First of all, oil price. That's the story from 1994 in real terms. So when this committee approved this Act in 2003, it couldn't have reasonably foreseen that most of the steep price was going to occur after this Act was passed. The simple point is the world has changed. Oil is now costing this economy 6.5 times what it cost in 1994 in real terms. So to just make an analogy, if you spend 1,000 rand a month on your petrol bill, suddenly it changes to 6,500 rand a month without an increase in your remuneration. That's an analogy for you. Didn't happen overnight, it happened since 1994, but it's a very significant change for this economy, which is dependent on this fuel. It's particularly significant for an export-oriented economy, where your industrial heartland is 600 odd kilometers from the sea. That stuff has to be transported, particularly more manufactured goods, which are not so easily transported by rail. It also says, is it time to rethink transport modes? It calls out for transport which is not propelled by oil, by other alternatives. It also suggests that if we're going to regulate petroleum, it should be particularly rigorous. And ironically, these higher prices suggest that competition should be that much keener because it's a scarcer and scarcer resource. And therefore the need for regulation might not be as imperative as it was in the past. You will be familiar with the structure on the left-hand side of the petrol price. These are all what we call the layers of the sandwich. Now the top layer is what's called the basic fuels price. And that translates, Esther, into the international component is 58% of the price. Let's call it 60% in round terms. So that is oil price and exchange rate driven. There's very little we can do anything about those things in South Africa, except perhaps the exchange rate. But even that, it's very difficult for us to do something about that. So 60% of the price is effectively out of our hands. I think you've missed something there. Let's go back. All right. So then let's talk about this oil that we are so dependent on. Oil exploration. We need our own oil because of this 6.5 times increase. In the last 8 years, there's been no oil production. Some of you will remember we used to produce oil from the Sable field and it dried up, and since then there's nothing. Should we be more worried about this? The Minerals and Petroleum Resources Development Act, which regulates upstream, is very important. And the review of that is very important if we want to get oil production going. The fact that we produced oil in this country, are we to believe that that Sable field was the only puddle of oil in the whole of South Africa and that there are no more to be found? Could we reasonably believe that? I don't believe that. But it means we have to get out and look for it, and that's very expensive, and it requires a regulatory dispensation which facilitates people spending hundreds of thousands of dollars at risk to drill wells which might be dry. If we come down to the retail price regulation, again, it's the same multi-layered slice of the petrol price sandwich, as we call it. All of those yellow elements are administered prices or locally regulated prices, and that accounts for just 18% of the petrol price. So all of this effort that Department of Energy and NERSA are putting into regulating petroleum only deals with 18% of the price. Our contribution from NERSA's side is 2% out of that 18. So we account for 2%, and 16% is the Department of Energy out of that whole petrol price. Now, if we look at what's happening in that section here, this is a representative pipeline, the Durban to Elroad. Elroad is a suburb of Johannesburg. So this is the sort of benchmark pipeline tariff. The green line is the nominal, or with inflation, and the red line is with inflation stripped out. So what you can see, looking at the red line, in real terms, the cost of piping petrol from Durban to Johannesburg is now lower than it was in 1992. But if you look at the way that green line is rising, that's a result of the Transnet multi-product pipeline project, which is under construction and has been under construction, some 25 billion rands worth. And the bad news is that line is going to carry on going up, because not all the capital has been brought into the regulatory asset base at this point in time. So it's quite possible that this red line is going to edge up here over the neutral dotted line. If we look at crude oil from Durban to Colebrook, which is Sasolburg, where the oil refinery is, it's also now cheaper than it was in 1992 in real terms. But again, you see in nominal terms, the tariff is going up, and it will continue to go up for the next few years before it starts to come down again. So that's the contribution NERSA has. This is now looking at that in context of all the other margins in the petrol price. The one that's rising steepest is the fuel tax, which is not the responsibility of the energy sector. The others are all parts of regulated margins. The green line is the transport costs, which is where NERSA comes in. If you go to the next slide, this has been simplified. So you can see the wholesale and retail margin combined is rising in real terms fairly steeply, as are the service cost recoveries and even the transport costs. Transport cost is not only pipeline tariffs that we regulate, it also includes an element of road transport. So you can see that in real terms, transport has increased 1.3 times, retail and wholesale 1.8 times, and service cost 2.5 times. That's 250%. In the old days, we used to talk about regulation as consumer price index minus X, which was an efficiency factor, not CPI times 2, for example. So this is what regulation is achieving. Storage tariffs that we regulate don't even feature in the petrol price regulation. They are not a component of it. If we look at the empowerment side of things, one indicator is access for third parties. Now, we've got tariffs, which people need to know in order to know what they'll pay to use a storage facility. So most of the storage facilities have got tariffs. We've got what are called third-party access mechanisms for most of the licensees. Those are the sort of the rules of access. How do you go about getting access to it? And the result after 9 years is 1.7% of total volumes are used by third-party access customers. And not very significant percentage. So the question is the regulation of petroleum achieving what you intended to achieve? We had the white paper, as I mentioned, in 98. We had the Pipelines Act, we had the National Energy Regulator Act, and now we have 9 years of experience of implementing this legislation. Is it achieving what it was intended to achieve? Now, normally what countries do is they make policy, they then make acts to give effect to policy, they then implement the acts, which is what we have done, and then at a certain point they say, all right, time to have a step back and have a look now. Are we achieving what we intended to achieve? I'm saying to you, it's normal and it's due. And indeed, the Petroleum Pipelines Levies Act actually has it as a requirement that there is a periodic review of are we achieving what we intended to achieve. Now, some of the next challenge, I touched on it earlier, is overlapping jurisdiction. You can see we have got 4 different acts which are involved in regulating petroleum on the downstream end. This is only on the downstream. And we've got different regulators. Department of Energy, NERSA, the ports regulator is regulating things in the ports, and the Transnet Act creates a regulator inside a commercial company called the Transnet National Ports Authority, which is also a regulator. So, if I may be so bold as to say, this is not the most elegant governance arrangement that could have been envisaged. So, what are we doing now with respect to these various things? With regard to overlapping jurisdictions, it's inhibiting the investment boom that I talked about. It's also giving investors a forum shopping gap to take. And investors can try to play one regulator off against another. What we are doing is we are trying to persuade the policy departments to jointly review the legislation. In particular, the Department of Energy and NERSA use different price methodologies for the very same asset. Now, what we've done is we've persuaded the department as a stopgap measure to amend the regulations, and they have published a draft which is currently out for public comment, which will close up in mid-December, and then hopefully there will be amendments. But that is, in our view, a stopgap measure. We also need to review the Act. The Transnet National Ports Authority is authorising investment in ports through various mechanisms such as bidding rounds and leases and so on. But the tariff is not included in those bids because that's a NERSA responsibility. So what we are doing is we are having close collaboration with the TNPA to try and address this problem. We're also persuading the policy departments to review the legislation. When it comes to the TNPA and NERSA, the term of the lease, that is for how many years long is the lease, and the depreciation that we are required to administer by regulation, they are not aligned. So, for example, if you have a 20-year lease, and it's a 40-year asset, it's expected to work for 40 years, it means in terms of our regulations, which we are obliged to administer, we must give depreciation over 40 years. But the investor wants to recover their investment in 20 years. Now, that clearly is a mismatch. So we've persuaded the TNPA to reconsider their term and how they deal with that, and we're also persuading the DOE to try to amend the regulations. Another complaint is about the tariffs and bankability. Investors are saying, look, they need certain tariffs in order to get bankable projects. And the key issue is not so much the cost of debt, but the cost of equity. What is the expectation of return that investors expect on their equity? We've just conducted this year a review, and we have revised upwards our returns on equity because we found that in private investors' expectations were considerably higher than what we were allowing. And some of the other inhibitors to investment are in the regulations, and as I've mentioned, the department has published draft amendments, which, if they are finally gazetted, will go some way to unblocking investment which is currently held up. Now, multiple regulators. In this value chain, we're talking about the petroleum value chain from well to wheels, as we call it. We've got 6 different economic regulators, all in one value chain. Is that? 5 of these 6 have got elements of overlapping jurisdiction. If we come to regulatory certainty for investors, we've got the same 6 regulators, and 3 and possibly 4 of the 6 have got their founding statutes currently under review. 6 overlapping regulators, 3 or 4 of them have their legislation under review. And we are saying regulatory certainty is what helps investors build infrastructure, which is what we need as a developmental state. So it's a golden opportunity to synchronize and align this legislation because there's so much change going on, and possibly this committee could play a crucial role in that. It's crucial to get these kinks ironed out, to get this sector really humming. And we are asking, can there be a coordinated review of all these pieces of legislation? Because if we continue to operate in silos, we continue to have unintended consequences and unintended overlaps and unintended blockages. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. First presentation.
Chair, through you, the penultimate, another terminal imaging death, which we have come and addressed the committee on, but there were certain further questions on specific areas we have wanted to cover. I'll ask Ms. Masete, the full-time regulator, member for CAPCAP, to then deal with that one.
Thank you, Chair, and good afternoon to the Honourable Member. It's already after 12. All right, I'm going straight to the presentation. The way in which we have prepared our presentation, we tried to answer the outline of the issues that were identified by the committee. So that's how we structured our presentation. So we're going to go through those issues. We started off, just so that we contextualize our presentation, we started off just to remind ourselves about the traditional natural gas value chain. If you look at the upstream level, you will see that we start with the exploration and production. And I think what is important there in that level of the value chain is the fact that that part of the value chain is not regulated by NERSA, it is regulated by part of the Petroleum Association of South Africa. NERSA only comes in at the midstream. Really, the midstream, it can take the processing as well as transportation, because the gas business really is about transportation. Once you extract what is under the ground, you've got to put it in the facilities for transportation, whether you put it in the pipeline for transportation or whether once you extract it, you put in those big met module cylinders for transportation. So NERSA will come in at that point. Just before you move on to the next slide, and again you have another level, which is the downstream. Then in the downstream, again, you find transportation as well as the end users. In our case, in the downstream, it will be the trading part. And in the trading part, again, NERSA comes in. So NERSA will come in from the licensing of the transportation. After the licensing, it must put a tariff for that transportation facility. And then later on, it will come in on the trading of the gas molecule itself. And the downstream there, there's also the municipalities that play a part there. We've also just summarized it again, just so that you can see the institutional arrangement in terms of the regulation of gas, just the landscape of the institutions that regulate pipe gas. Now, if you look at the upstream, we just mentioned that the gas that we currently regulating at NERSA is the natural gas, which comes from Mozambique, plus the synthetic gas or the methane-rich gas, the one that is produced in Secunda. All of that gas, the methane-rich gas as well as the one that we import in Mozambique, is owned by Sasol Gas. And then the regulator for the exploration and production, it is obviously PASA. And then also in the upstream, you will find, you will also have the domestic gas and resources. And then you move on to the midstream. In terms of the current infrastructure in the midstream, we have Romco that owns the pipeline. You recall that Romco is the Republic of Mozambique pipeline company. And you've got EGAS there as a shareholder, you've got Sasol as a shareholder, and you've got another Mozambican company as a shareholder under Romco. And you also have Sasol Gas that owns the transmission pipeline. You also have Transnet that owns the transmission pipeline right from the area of Middelburg down to KZN. And then you also have the smaller pipelines, which is your distribution pipeline. Currently, you only have Sasol Gas that owns those pipelines. But recently at NERSA, we have just licensed other entities for distribution, which is Columbus Steel. They've owned that pipeline for a number of years. It's in Mpumalanga. And then another small one, which is PF Glass, which is in Spring, but it's for their own supply, just to reduce the cost of distribution that is being charged by Sasol Gas. And in that way, they're also reducing the price of gas to themselves. Right, if you look at the downstream, I made mention of the trading, and those are the players. Then if you look at the right-hand side, you will see that there's Sasol, there is the trader, and you also have Springlife Gas, which is in KZN, and we also have Reapile. We do have others that are traders as well, but the gas that they supply, they put it in cylinders, and it gets compressed, and that is the gas that they supply mainly to the transportation center, where you see these taxis get converted or buses get converted. They use the natural gas that we normally call compressed natural gas. We just make an observation here regarding the sort of the state of competition. If you look at the fact that Sasol Gas owns the gas, it also owns the infrastructure where you're supposed to put in that gas. But again, it is a player downstream to compete with its own customers. And then if you look at the level of competition, then that's where we say that then it will have a competitive advantage over the others in terms of the price and in terms of how much gas is needed. For example, if these traders are saying that their business is looking good, and the fact that they are competing directly with the price of fuel, of petrol and diesel, now they need more gas, then Sasol will have to supply them. But Sasol, if they say that they are constrained in terms of the supply, they decide to give themselves 90% of the gas that they own, and then they're only left with 10%. So there isn't much, even if they want some more. So you'll have a gap in terms of the demand. If you can move on to the next slide. Here we just make an observation of some of the challenges that we face in terms of the market, the current market structure, which is a vertically integrated market structure. As I may mention, Sasol Gas owns not only the product itself, participate downstream from the exploration, from the midstream, and also in terms of the trading, and it owns again the infrastructure. So what does that tell us? We may need, if we're really committed to switching to gas and enjoy that golden age of gas, we may need to look at the diversification of gas supply to make sure that there's another alternative supplier of gas so that we do not rely on one entity to supply gas. These are just some of the observations. I'm not going to get those observations about some of the disadvantages of that market structure, the vertically integrated market structure. Now, in terms of the infrastructure, where is this infrastructure? Who owns it? Where is it located? So that even if you're thinking of importation of gas, you have a sense as to, if you talk about the LNG, the liquefied natural gas, where can it be located? Where can it be supplied? Or where is the demand? If you're looking at the Western Cape and you think that there could be a good opportunity for gas because there's immediate demand in the Western Cape, if you consider what Mr. Netezo presented earlier on regarding the expensive diesel, where diesel could actually be displaced and you put gas in terms of those OCGTs, then you're looking at the infrastructure and you think that that could also be the opportunity for LNG to be imported via the Western Cape. Now, looking at just the pipeline, because we've got many technologies in terms of transportation, When you look at the pipeline, we're starting from the gas fields somewhere in Mozambique, which those gas fields will be defined, the Germany, it goes down to Mpumalanga and Secunda, and then the network on the transmission side, it goes to Gauteng and some parts of Free State. And then from the KZN side, you have the Transnet pipeline. It connects to the Sasol pipeline, which comes from Secunda. It goes down to Middelburg, and somewhere in Middelburg, the Transnet pipeline connects to the Sasol pipeline. Now, if you look on the right-hand side, we're just observing the reticulation network that is owned by Ebony Gas in some parts of the Johannesburg area. And then in Centurion is a small company called South Down Management. It's got a reticulation network somewhere in Centurion. And then if you go down, I'm not sure if that picture is visible enough, that's where you have the compressed natural gas. So they get their gas from Sasol gas, and that gas gets injected into these tubes, these MET modules. And then these MET modules are carried out, are carried by those trucks and they get in those covers there. And this will be their sort of a compressor station. They will have a mother station and a daughter station where they have a compressor station, and then get the gas, they get injected into those MET modules. Just to look at the size of the network, I've already mentioned all the players that own that network, distribution and as well as the transmission. In total, that is the size of the pipeline network that we have licensed. And then when you come to distribution, that is the size, only 317 kilometers of the distribution pipeline that NERSA has licensed. Now, we also licensed those MET modules that we have seen in the previous slide. You can move on. Right here, we're just mentioning the players in the market. And in terms of trading, who is trading downstream? Sasol. Sasol competes, potentially, it will have to compete with its own customers that buy the gas from them. In terms of the compressed natural gas, we think that it is growing steadily. As you can see, the number of vehicles, 669 vehicles that were converted, which are now running on natural gas. We'll move on to the next one. Now, just looking at the regulation of gas, you know, looking at the history in the regulation of gas. The gas industry is quite small. We started regulating this industry in 2005 when NERSA was established. But at the beginning of regulation of the gas industry, the industry itself was regulated in terms of the Sasol regulatory agreement, giving effect to the arrangement of the cross-border gas trade between South Africa and Mozambique. So we regulated prices, tariffs, and supply in terms of the provisions of that Sasol regulatory agreement until March 2014. Now, after March 2014, it was after now 10 years in terms of the dispensation that was provided to Sasol, granted to Sasol gas, from the 26th of March of this year, the Gas Act then came into force. Now, prices, tariffs, and supply conditions are regulated in terms of the Gas Act. In terms of the scope of regulation, what is it that we regulate as NERSA? We are supposed to regulate all hydrocarbon gases. And in this one, I would like to make mention that in the definition of gas, they even include LPG, and we know that LPG currently in terms of prices is regulated by the Department of Energy. We also regulate compressed natural gas. We know that if you focus mainly on the definition, you will only think of the pipeline, but the technologies, they change. So we also regulate CNG as well as the LNG. On this one, we just make mention that currently we don't regulate LPG because it is not transported by pipeline. So we actually note here the fragmentation itself, because the product itself is regulated by the Department of Trade, the Department of Energy in terms of the prices. But also from our side, from the Petroleum Pipelines Act, Dr. Compton mentioned the LPG in terms of just the infrastructure, the storage facilities. So again, there we make observation of the fragmentation. Now, In terms of the regulatory mandate, in a nutshell, I'm not going to repeat those functions or the objectives of the Act. What is it that we want to achieve by regulating the gas industry? We want to make sure that there's an orderly development of the industry, first of all. But how do you do that? How do you make sure that when you grow this industry, when you develop the industry, you grow it in an orderly manner? And also, as you grow the industry, wanting more infrastructure, you need to make sure that that is done in a responsible way, that you make sure that the industry itself is competitive, and we must facilitate investment and promote access to gas at affordable levels of prices. And we also license the infrastructure, approving tariffs. We do not set tariffs, we do not set prices. Our mandate is much weaker than the mandate of the other two sectors that are regulated by NERSA. Now, we're now zooming into the mandate that we are given in terms of prices and tariffs. In terms of the Gas Act, we can only monitor and approve tariffs, and if necessary, we can regulate. Now, we have developed the tariff guidelines in 2009 so that there's a predictability in the way in which we'll exercise that mandate. In terms of the Gas Act, also when it comes to prices, we approve maximum prices, not actual prices, but the maximum prices to all classes of customers. But before we can approve the prices, we need to make sure that there's no competition, or the adequacy of competition is doesn't exist in the market. So as you can see, the Gas Act makes a clear distinction between a tariff and a price. So if you look at those two, it means that the price that you see at the end of the day is a price that will add all the slices. It will be a price that will have at the bottom of the slice, you'll have the price for the gas molecule. And then you add all the tariffs, the distribution tariff, the transmission tariff. If there are storage that we license, you also add the storage, you also add the margin. So the price keeps going up in terms of all those slices until at the end of the day, you have the total price. Now, I'm looking at the methodology that we use in terms of coming to those prices. We are using two methodologies. The one methodology is where we track the price of gas, looking at the potential substitutes. It's not closed substitutes, but the potential substitute, that is other energy indicators. And those energy indicators will be coal, diesel, electricity, heavy fuel, oil, as well as LPG. We have also put some weights here, and then what we do a weighted average, and then we come to the gas energy price, not the tariffs, but just the price itself. In the alternative, we are now looking forward to the potential entrants, such as the LNG or some domestic gas developments. We thought that let's also come up with a pass-through mechanism. And then in terms of the pass-through mechanism, they will have to demonstrate all the costs that they've incurred in the supply of gas. And then we do the total and we do the prudence test. We're just demonstrating here again the way in which we determine the total price of gas. And it is because of the legislation that we are implementing as well as the regulation. In terms of the methodology that I have just outlined, it has to do with the maximum price of gas. And not the actual price, but the maximum price of gas, how it will be determined. You determine it by making reference to other energy indicators. Then in addition to this, you add the transmission tariff. That transmission tariff, it is regulated by NERSA, so that will be the second slice on top of the first one. And then you add the distribution tariff. That is where there's a regulatory gap. NERSA doesn't regulate this, and we think that there was an oversight, and this is now being corrected under the Gas Amendment Bill. And then we also regulate the trading margin. We allow the traders to have a margin. So what you do not see here is the storage tariff, because we have not licensed storage. For example, if there's LNG importation, it's a liquefied gas, but when it gets landed, you need to again convert it into a gas form. So you will have a regasification tariff that you will have to add here. Then that will take you to the total price of gas. Go to the next one. Now we're just sharing with the members here in terms of now the tariff. How do we determine the tariff? In terms of our methodology, we allow for flexibility for it for investors. We do not fix the method into, say, for example, the first one, the rate of return, because our mandate is to approve. So we look at what the applicant has used. If the applicant has used the rate of return, we test the reasonableness of that calculation. And then here are other alternatives that we use, as well as the discounted cash flow. These are the only two that we have used so far. The first one, the rate of return, as well as the discounted cash flow. I think that summarizes that. We can move on to the next one. Now we're trying to answer the question that was asked by the committee members in terms of the processes that we follow in making the decisions. In terms of licensing, pricing, and tariff, and we have just done the summary of that decision-making process. And if we look at the impact of the decisions on pipe gas to date, we are looking at the decision that was made on the 28th of October 2011. That has to do with the methodology to approve maximum prices in South Africa. And then the other decision that we're going to share with you is the one where we have approved the maximum price application by Sasol Gas. These are just the steps that we followed right at the beginning of the methodology. It was such an extensive process, and we started by developing the document, the consultation document. We have had some discussions with the stakeholders, we organized the workshops, until we came up with a formula of calculating the price. And these are just the workshops and the dates when we held those workshops. Now we got to the phase two. It was a lengthy process. Phase two, we then consulted on the weights that must be apportioned on each of that of the energy indicators, that is the coal, diesel, electricity, and LPG. How much weight must be put there? Again, we went through a long consultation process. Now, after we have now approved the methodology itself, we could not implement it immediately. We had to get to another stage of making sure that competition does exist in the market before we can actually exercise our rights or intervene on prices, because we cannot just intervene without making sure that competition does not exist. So we had to go through a process, and at the end of it, we found that competition does not exist, and that's when NERSA started to approve prices for different licensees. Now, what were the key considerations and the views that were expressed by stakeholders regarding the methodology itself? They wanted to make sure that, and also from our side, wanted to make sure that the prices are not too low such that they will lead to the depletion of this scarce resource. So, and that was the concern also from the trader. And also that prices must not be too high, because then it will be difficult for customers to afford. So we're also keeping in mind the objectives of the Gas Act. And the prices that we must come up with are the prices that must reflect, that must not reflect the current prices that are charged by Sasol Gas, but they must mimic a competitive outcome. And that traders must not be discouraged, must not be disadvantaged by the fact that Sasol, you know, owns the price, and what price are they going to charge if Sasol price charges them a higher price? What the traders are going to charge to its own customers and be able to compete with Sasol Gas? There were certain criticism regarding the weights that were apportioned under each. Some they wanted a higher weight on coal, some they wanted a higher weight, for example, on the LPG and HFO, but we only put 1% and 1% for each of the HFO, as well as the LPG. In terms of the data sources, where do we get the data? We use the publication that is done by the Department of Energy when it comes to some of the indicators. Now, in terms of the conclusions, we are saying that at the end of the day, why did we do this? We want to make sure that we attract investment. You need to give certainty so that you can be in a position to effect the diversification of supply that you want to see, and you want to make sure that you get to the stage where there is competition or gas-to-gas competition, but it's not something that is going to be achieved overnight. That is not possible. So until you facilitate entry, because if you still have one supplier, you're not going to be able to get to that competition that you want to see at the end of the day. So it was a complex process in the way in which the maximum prices were supposed to be determined as well as the tariff. Because first of all, you are not setting the price. You must approve the price, but you must come up with a fair mechanism of how do you approve the price and what price you are supposed to approve. Now, the possible effects of the decision on the gas sector is the limitation of the possibility of undue price discrimination. We believe that we have made some progress here because there was a perfect price discrimination in terms of the previous regime, which we implemented over a period of 10 years. And what we have seen in terms of the new prices is that there were price reductions for a number of customers, for many customers, particularly small customers and some of the big customers. And now with the new regime, it at least gives NERSA power to regulate gas prices upfront rather than come later on and monitor what prices were charged, for example, by fossil gas in terms of the previous regime. We also want to give certainty to investors. If we want them to invest, whether they invest in shale gas, they must know at least at the end of the day what price is going to be approved or charged. And we also want to facilitate investment and entry into the gas sector. Now, so far, we have approved these prices for the different traders. These prices are going to be adjusted, some of them, on a quarterly basis. I'm going to skip this slide. This is just the process, again, that we had followed when we approved the price for Sasol gas. Now, in terms of the impact of that maximum price, we have observed that 66% of Sasol customers benefited from price reductions, and that shows how many of the customers, 342 of 522 customers that were that are buying gas from Sasol gas. Of the 20 customers that consume 80% of external volumes from Sasol gas, then we also saw a price reduction for 25%. We'll see about price reductions from Sasol gas. This is just a graph that shows some of the price concessions that were made by Sasol gas. How does the gas energy price compare with international energy prices? We're trying to show how does the gas price in South Africa compare with prices elsewhere in the world. So we are looking at all those countries there for those years, 2011, 2012, and 2013, and South Africa is right there in the middle at the price of about 137. This is an average price. This is an average price of gas at 79 cents. If they look at all customers, the average price will be that. This is the price now when you do the adjustments as well as adding the tariffs. Remember, in terms of our regulatory framework, if, for example, we have approved that price of 117 from Sasol gas, that was the maximum that we have approved, 117. Now, in addition to this, you will have to add the tariffs, transmission tariff, which is about 5.9 cents, ROMPO tariff, which is about 11 rands, as well as the distribution tariff, which is plus minus 11 rands. So it will take you to that figure that you see there, and then you compare that with the other prices around the world. But it has included a maximum, not the actual price. We are now showing here the average price of gas. Right, and now in terms of that total maximum gas charge, it excludes distribution. It just includes the transmission tariff. So the prices, again, we are just showing here for each of the classes of customers. The lowest class here, those that are consuming lower volumes. So they will pay a price that is up there, just below 140. But again, here we calculated the gas price at the maximum. And then you also have those that are consuming slightly higher volumes up to the last class that we have in our regulations. The next one, it includes now the distribution tariff. You can see for those that are consuming very low quantities of gas, their price is slightly, if you look at this, for Gauteng, the price is slightly high. And then if you look at Secunda, those that are close to Secunda, and then they are taking the methane-rich gas, that is the price that they pay. And then in KwaZulu-Natal, the price is sitting there. So these are the lowest volumes. As you go to your right-hand side, it will be the larger volumes of gas, so bigger customers. Now again, we try to, again, just compare the South African gas price. That is the natural gas, but we're comparing it with the LNG prices around the world, and those are landed prices as at November 2013. And it is important to note that these LNG prices, they do not include the regasification cost. So the regasification becomes the regasification tariff that is not included in here. So if you look at the South African price here, we're sitting at about $12. Okay, if you can move on. But just to share again, in terms of the previous regime, the complaints that we have handled as NERSA, in terms of just transparency and the efforts that we have made in terms of our enforcement as NERSA, in terms of the previous pricing regime, we received about 7 pricing complaints. And these are really formal complaints. There were other complaints that were not lodged formally, but we resolved them. So in terms of those that were lodged formally with NERSA, we investigated 7. And most of them, all of them, customers got price reductions in terms of those complaints. And the complaints were about excessive pricing. Some of them were price discrimination complaints. But we made findings mainly on excessive pricing. Now, in terms of our own investigations, we initiated investigations into 16 customers, not 16 investigations, but investigations into affairs of 16 customers under the MPP. And we made findings that there was compliance in certain instances, and in some instances there was no compliance. Where there was no compliance, the price came down, and some of the customers benefited from some of them 50% on average, 50% price reduction. Now, in terms of the new regime on the right-hand side, so far we only received about 2 complaints, and the 2 complaints relate to price discrimination as well as the incorrect implementation of the approved maximum prices. The future of gas prices in South Africa. What is the future of gas prices in South Africa? What will drive the gas prices in South Africa? It is not easy for us at this point to say how we can give a certain forecast or projected prices in South Africa, what will happen in 10 years' time. Because what we're looking at is a situation where there's gas-to-gas prices, just like what happens in other parts of the world, for example, in the UK as well as in the US. But we haven't reached that stage. We are still an infant industry in South Africa. We are hoping that as the industry grows and you see entry into the industry, that entry and more players in the industry will drive gas prices down. So if you look at the gas prices that were regulated in terms of the Sasol agreement for the past 10 years, some of those prices were very high. As I stated, about 66% of customers of Sasol have seen price reduction. So prices came down after we implemented the maximum price in March of this year. So the impact assessment as well is something that we will continuously do to just check the impact of the maximum prices and also compare our prices with the prices around the world. And we are saying, I think our main statement here is that competition must drive prices down, and that the gas prices, there must be gas-to-gas competition that we want to see in the long run. Challenges and goals, starting with the policy or regulatory challenges. we want to comment on the light-handed regulatory approach where we are approving instead of setting prices, and we're hoping that the department is going to rectify this in terms of the gas amendment bill. Weak enforcement, I think that is another key message here that we would like to leave with the members here, that in terms of our enforcement model, we are not in a position to impose any administrative fine if there's no compliance. So, and all that we can do is just a notice of non-compliance and nothing more than that. So if parties continuously or repeatedly contravene the legislation, there's nothing that you can do. You just say to them, note that you are contravening legislation. And what will be the next step? The next step, you are supposed to impose administrative fines, and you are not in a position to do so. We're hoping that the legislation that is being amended, it will deal with those challenges so that they strengthen our enforcement model so that we can also increase our enforcement efforts and also give us a much more stronger power so that we don't approve but we set prices. The other thing is that there's a gap in terms of how the industry is regulated. We do not regulate the distribution tariff. So there is a gap that could lead to unintended consequences. Currently, the distribution tariff is very high if you compare it with the transmission tariff. Again, for where you want to introduce transformation in the industry and introduce more small players in the industry, you are not able to do that because in the distribution, they do not allow mandatory third party access in the infrastructure. So if you want small players to come in or even to introduce competition and transform the industry so that there's more than one player in the industry, you should be able to allow for mandatory third party access. We're hoping that these are going to be corrected in the current gas amendment bill. Now, in terms of the policy initiatives or the plans by the department, we think that it is important that gas must be seen to play a prominent role in terms of the current plans, that is the integrated energy plan, and also the coordination of that plan with the GAMP that is being developed currently. We think that those must talk to each other as well as the IRP. Now, also, we think that it is important that there is much more coordination between the different government departments, especially if you're looking at the MPRDA as well as the GAS Act. So if you allow that coordination and clarity in terms of the mandate of NERSA and the mandate of PASA, I think that will also provide some certainty that is required by investors. And also, to be clear, if the shale gas is going to be regulated upstream by PASA, then it must be very clear at what point does NERSA come in to regulate that gas. Now, in terms of the challenges again that we have observed, I think again it talks to the plans that are in place currently and some of the initiatives that are taken by various stakeholders where we do not see coordination, and we think that government could come up with a process, even if it's through the GAM process, whereby the various industry players who have conducted feasibility studies, some of them they are planning LNG importation projects, but there is no coordination currently, you know, and they are all targeting almost the same end customer. So it's very important that there must be a process that allows stakeholders to coordinate their initiatives so that it is clear what plans are there for stakeholders so that we do not duplicate the work that has already been done, even in terms of feasibility. Now, the other challenges that are affecting the gas industry is the fact that there's no conventional gas storage facilities in South Africa. And the mobile storage units in terms of the compressed natural gas, they are very small to can be used for storing gas. And also the licensing scheme for distribution, it has a tendency of foreclosing the market because there's no mandatory third-party access and the areas for distribution are exclusive to those that have been licensed as distributors. There's no competition at all, even if we want to introduce some transformation there for participation by other players. We have done something in this. We have excised some of the licenses or areas that were previously licensed. We excised them to the extent that Sasol Gas did not develop them further. So we're opening it up for competition. We enforce compliance with Regulation 3, which gives us eligible customer right to buy gas directly from suppliers so that they do not have to buy from the exclusive area. They can buy from anybody else, but this is just an artificial way of doing it, because in reality, it's only Sasol Gas who supplies the gas. We also have limited access to gas supply. We're asking for a diversification of gas supply. And the least development of gas infrastructure is only available in four provinces, Gauteng, Free State, Mpumalanga, and KZN. And we think that it is important to facilitate entry, facilitate in gas infrastructure investment so that you can diversify the sources of gas. We think that through these gas exploration activities, we could come to a stage where at least we see more than one supplier of gas. If, for example, the project that is taking place here in Cape Town, the Sunbed Energy, it comes to fruition, the Ibubesi gas field gets developed, we think that it will make a difference, particularly here in the Western Cape, where you observe immediate demand and that use of diesel in the peak plants here in the Western Cape. There are some companies that have done some studies here just to show the cost savings for the country. If, for example, you were to replace the use of diesel with gas, you could see huge cost savings for the country, and also in terms of recovering that cost through the regulatory clearing account that Mr. Ngetezo talked about earlier on. And not only on this, but if you also use gas for those intermittencies through the renewable energy, gas is quite efficient, it is quite quick. If the wind doesn't blow, if the sun doesn't shine, the gas will be there, it will come in. So we think that it will deal with some of those challenges. So we think that the work that is being done currently, and the interest, I think this is showing the investment appetite, that investor, the interest that is shown by investors in South Africa now that they've started the exploration on gas as well as oil in South Africa. I think if there are very good policy signals, it could encourage investment in South Africa. And also there are feasibility studies. I've talked about these feasibility studies that were conducted by a number of companies. You've got Sasol that is doing something on the side. You've got PetroSA that is doing something on the side on the LNG imports. You also have Shell as well. So I think sometimes this work needs to be coordinated at some point. If there's a process such as the GAMP process, the gas utilization master plan, so that these companies can actually come forward and show what is it that they can do. But also we are saying that even in the IRP, where there's allocation for gas, if the calls are made for gas, companies may come forward through the procurement process and show or demonstrate what is it that they can do. So if the implementation of those allocations, it comes to the fore, we believe that at least there will be a step closer to bringing an alternative supplier of gas. But all of these attempts, the feasibility studies, the money that has been spent by various investors exploring coal bed methane and LNG, all of those attempts will be futile if there's no certainty on the anchor customer. And the anchor customer, as we stated before, these companies have stated, to justify that huge investment, it will have to be the electricity generation. So you need the interdependencies to work in this regard. So the anchor customer, again, should justify the development of these domestic gas fields, and also for the major gas infrastructure to support LNG as well as the domestic gas. Some of the things that we have observed when we conducted the NERSA dialogues is the fact that the reason why you do not see the gas infrastructure investment, it is because of the credit worthiness of the off-takers. So it is also an issue that needs to be looked at. difficulties in securing finance for large gas projects, it is also an issue. We're making some propositions here as to what can be done. Because of large investments that are required, it is important to look at strategic partnerships. We've seen them working, these strategic partnerships. We think that is something that must be encouraged going forward. Can move on to the next one. Again, here we just delve into those difficulties that we have identified in relation to securing finance for large gas projects. On this one, we're talking about the short, medium, and long-term goals in terms of facilitating security of gas supply. There's some work that we do at NERSA just to monitor what is happening in the industry, not only in South Africa, but regionally and around the world. So we always come up with reports on a quarterly basis to observe those new gas finds and what South Africa can do or other gas infrastructure investments where, for example, in Mozambique, they've developed the LNG export facility. So in South Africa, we can take an advantage of that and import gas from Mozambique, for example, not only through the Romco pipeline that is existing, but also importing LNG, and also in Ghana and other countries. And then in terms of promoting competition, what is it that we are doing? And also making sure that there's efficient functioning of the gas sector. We enforce the third-party access. If you want to transform the sector and you want to introduce competition where it is needed or to diversify the supply, you've got to enforce third-party access where you allow other parties to utilize the existing infrastructure without having to duplicate that infrastructure because sometimes it's just expensive. They can pay a cost for it. Development of mechanisms for facilitating that third-party access in existing facilities, and we also conduct some regular competition assessment and market inquiries in the gas industry. These are the efforts that we make in trying to facilitate investment and ensure that there's affordable and accessibility to the gas that we regulate. Now, lastly, I'm just dealing with the key messages. The key messages are the fact that there are challenges that are facing South African gas sector, and that continues to hamper the development of this industry. And in that regard, as we have seen, as we have heard from the various players who really want to come into this industry and invest in this industry, some of them, they need some policy certainty, particularly now that there are these plans that are still being developed. Growing the gas industry will require more gas, as well as the gas infrastructure. They go hand in hand. You need more gas, and if the gas is available in South Africa through the shale gas or other small developments, the gas fields, but you also have gas in the neighboring countries, how do you take advantage of that? So we need to invest in gas infrastructure. Gas to power is seen as a key enabler for further gas market development. So that is the anchor customer that we're talking about, and where we need very firm implementation, not only of the GAMP, if the GAMP gets approved, but also the allocations for gas in the IRP. The interdependencies between electricity and gas must be exploited, and I've just mentioned the point there regarding the cost savings that we can enjoy if then we consider gas and move towards that golden age of gas. The next slide, please. Gas supply, we think that it is no longer an issue. Gas is available. All that needs to be done is take advantage of the gas that is actually next door in Mozambique and in other countries. The gas strategy aligned with GAMP is needed to give policy certainty to grow the gas market, and also the alignment with the existing plans, the IRP, the IEP, and the GAMP. I think it is very important because the GAMP is still at the development stage. The next one. I think also the alignment of legislation regulating gas around the country is also very important. Okay. Thank you very much, members, for your attention.
Yeah. Thank you, Chairperson. Is the move to slide 184? 184. Move to slide 184.
Chair, the one of the issues that we're requested to cover is indicates how our planning is time-based, short, medium, and long-term. In the interest of time, I'm just going to focus on this slide. Members can read at their own time the detail that goes behind the slide. Not only from a regulatory point of view, perhaps one should start by saying that regulation and regulatory work is tedious. You know, people will apply for licenses, you have to process licenses. People will apply for tariffs, you have to... So that bit will continue to be tedious in that sense. However, as an organization, we have set ourselves goals utilizing the organizational maturity model, and we're saying that in indicating the different phases, the top left corner is where we are now. In the short term, we'll move to the bottom left corner where we're looking at the reporting, at regulatory reporting, both through the manuals and the system for that, the harmonization of tariff methodologies. And at the corporate level, we're looking at a business process review. In the medium term, we'll look at our systems. We will look at the regulatory impact assessment. In fact, we have started with that particular process. And this regulatory impact assessment is the ex post, as they call it. We are going to look at the decisions that the organization has taken in the last 7 to 9 years and say what has been the impact on the South African economy. We'll also target becoming ISO certified so that the organization performs at a high level. And lastly, in terms of long term, we're looking at growing our presence, continuously improving, but importantly, advocating for a regulatory regime that has got consequences. I think members would have heard the refrain from all three colleagues about how limited the authority of the regulator is to deal with non-compliant entities. And one of the key things that we'll be advocating for is a regulatory regime essentially that's got consequences so that we are able to deal with those who do not comply. Chair, I know that we have almost killed the committee by PowerPoint, but we were trying to respond to the instructions, Chair. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much. Honourable members, I suggest we try and close this session in line with the time we have on our agenda. I don't know if there are... I only want to take process suggestions, not questions, about what we do with the presentation. Because clearly there isn't much we can do about the presentation now. Given the fact that we must stop, close the meeting in the next 2 minutes. Any suggestions? Honourable Esteban.
Chair, thank you. It was a very long presentation. I've got quite a lot of questions, actually. Quite a lot to say, and I'm sure a lot of the other members as well. And if we don't do it now, it won't have the same impact. I would maybe that if all the members agree, we stay a little bit longer. But the presentation was quite longer than what was actually on the agenda. Okay.
Yes, process suggestions that don't take me beyond 1 o'clock.
Chair, can I suggest that we submit questions in writing to NERSA and set a deadline for responses, although I think the presentation was incredibly comprehensive and answered a lot of our long-standing questions. I know, but we do have a few that we could possibly submit in writing and hopefully have before the end of the term. Thanks, Chair.
I think the most reasonable suggestion to make at this point is for members to submit their questions. So I want to suggest that you have some time to submit your questions latest this Friday. We'll send them to NERSA. NERSA should be able to take you 1 week to prepare your questions and send them back to us. So this Friday and then the following Friday, NERSA will come back to us. You do remember that we have an outstanding strategic session. We may want to decide at that point what we want to do with the issues arising from this presentation going forward. So thanks very much for your understanding. It was a very long presentation. I had anticipated that it would take us about this time. NERSA, thank you very much for a very long day. Doesn't seem to me that we'll have time this year, but we'll definitely see you sometime during the course of next year. So, honorable members, when are we meeting? Yes. Next Tuesday, the 18th. Okay. See you next Tuesday. Enjoy your lunch.